Oh my God. I'm
we
so
are
sorry.
That's fine. And we are actually live and recording right now.
Great. Yep. Well, you know, it didn't work on my iPad, but it worked on my iPhone. So here we are talking about the tech age anyway. So there we have
it. So if everybody wants to know what's going on with this craziness, we have been sitting here for the past 15, 20 minutes trying to figure out how to get this communication application. Different systems, and we couldn't. So now we have it. Now we have it figured out, right?
Mm-hmm, we do.
Awesome. All right, everybody. We're here with Michelle Manu, and she is a female warrior of the Hawaiian people. That is Michelle. I don't know how to communicate what ranking is in the martial arts for Hawaiian stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's different. I mean, it's not the ancient times, which, you know, a lot of my work has to do with trying to bring those virtues and those qualities back into today's life. But it really, there's three well-known Lua lineages, and the rest are obviously there's Lua warriors and families that knew Lua on every island, and their styles are very different, and they're not as organized as the three that are most known. And because, you know, all of the Asian cultures passed through Hawaii on the way to the mainland, the Hawaiian arts kind of took on similar ranking that they had when they passed through to make it viable. So right now there's also the Royal Order of Kamehameha the First, which is an organization that's men only. And they really protect, preserve, and promote the Hawaiian culture. All those things that are true to the culture, not a lot of the hearsay that a lot of people hear over the years, talk story, as people would say. So my ranking is more organized. It's a developed art. It's of the Kaiwalu lineage. And my Alohe is the third Alohe or master in his family. And so I've been blessed in an energetic sense, not a Christian sense, but like truly blessed lifelong to be able to be the only woman ranked as high as I am, and to be given the unlimited blessing to teach. So that's what you have.
Cool. All right. So that gives us a start. Uh-huh. And I kind of want to rush up on what it is that the Viking of Ahala Project is trying to do. Those of you that have listened in before, I was really concerned with pressing men's issues and things that are burdening men, because I personally don't think that I can speak for women on almost any level. Yeah, so there's that happens in the world when people get these preferential concepts in their head that they feel that they can speak for another group of people. And I'd like to... I can't speak for anybody, anybody else, let alone a different gender or different anything. So, so what I guess I'm trying to do here with the Viking Valhalla Project is a little bit of cultural preservation, as well as introducing people to new concepts. And usually these concepts that are new are old.
Mm.
Like some of the stuff that I do is so old, it might as well be alien technology to people. They've never seen it. So with what you're doing, it's kind of struck me as interesting, and I wanted to let you kind of get into that a little bit, because I'd seen that you're involved a little bit in acting and some stunt coordination or fight scene coordination stuff, and I think that's awesome, and I kind of want to get into that with you, because this has been so heavily male dominated.
Mm.
And this is, watch, I'm doing that wind chime thing, so I'm coming back to I think that men's issues involve women.
And women's issues involve men. I mean, we can't get away from each other. We love each other. We hate each other. And then you've got society telling us that we both need to be something that we really, how we're not made. And this is the imbalance that we see today. But we can touch on that later.
Yeah, we're going to touch on some stuff here. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting here. I'm drinking while I'm doing this. And because it's late. And so for you, I if you could tell me what is the differences between like the martial arts that I do, if you're kind of more traditional, look at you may not understand the word sambo, but you'd understand the word judo. Mm-hmm. You understand sambo? All right. So what is the difference? Share something with me. Tell me what's going on.
Well, this is the funny thing. I mean, it's all physics. If you look at it, it's all body mechanics and movements and how each practitioner, regardless of the art form, chooses to express their energy. So, you know, whether they have a penis, they have a vagina, or they're Chinese or they're white, it doesn't matter. We're human and we're able to move in a certain way, and we're able to progress as we condition, like we age as we maintain. So I would say there's some redirection. There's a lot of locking. The Lua that I know is there's no wasted animal movements. And so the Lua is air, sea, and land animals, as well as nature movements, all combined. And you can do up to 7 animals or more in one technique. And it's basically about, Lua means pit in the martial arts combat sense. In the ancient times, to take your waste to behind the house and bury it in a deep, dark pit. And so in a lot of movements in the Lua that I've been trained in, it's to actually use the ground to bust your opponent. So there is, in the difference of judo or even Aikido, and there's these beautiful, I don't know, throws where your opponent, it's absolutely gorgeous. I love watching it, but that's definitely not the principle in Lua. It's to dislocate as many joints and tear flesh and muscle while you're almost like a corkscrewing your opponent down into a pit and locking them up as they hit the ground. So in that sense, it's not, it's really hard to show this in a sports environment. And I know we hear that because, you know, it's real, it's combat, it's self-defense, and you can't do it in sports, you know, but in reality, you have to wash. I've actually on one project, it was actually with Matt Simber, who was one of the founders of Glow back in the 80s. He started a whole new branch off, and I was in the pilot for about a year and a half. It's called Femme to Action. And, you know, he had us train with one of the executive producers who was Taekwondo. And so 4 of us little actresses went down to the dojo where he was teaching and literally made me fight every single person in that class. But as we progressed, you know, I got through 2 people, and then I got through 2 more people, and he said, okay, no more shots. You can no longer kick below the belt. And I said, those are all of our kicks. That's all emulated after the stomping pig, the pua'a. So it's a lot of sweeps and trapping of the legs and then breaking the joint in an opposite way while the other leg is, you know, their foot is lodged behind it. You know, a lot of stomping kicks to the joints and even straight, my favorite, like the crooked kick. It looks really weird. I know it looks like a knife kick and an inward knife kick in some other arts, but the knee's actually bent and it's the hips that propel it forward to where you can actually kick the groin on an angle, thus crooked kick. So those are my favorites. They're powerful. And so when he took away half of my weapons by the time I got to fight him, you know, and that's just not fair. So I think those are just the differences that the sparring can, we get hurt pretty badly. I've had a lot of injuries, including half of my rib cage cracked. I mean, and still having to show up to class with a brace on and thinking that my Alohe didn't know, but he knew, you know. I mean, when you can't breathe and you can't miss a class and they go sometimes 5 hours, that's a lot, you know. So it's just the training's it's a lot old school. It's in the elements, in the water, in the heat, in the direct sun, in the rain, so in the mud. So it's a lot of having to really use your core and your agility, and really training those tendons, you know, that you don't necessarily get training in at the gym, you know. So that's primarily the difference. It's just to a different level. I mean, all arts are amazing and they all have their purpose and they all are related because it's just human movement, but it's different in the dislocation focus. That's the intent.
I had seen some of the Hawaiian styles come out in the early UFCs. And I'm not exactly sure how they got so involved in the early UFCs. And I'm not sure, do you even know what I'm talking about?
I do. I know of one specific fighter that really wasn't Lua. He came to train in Lua, I think, maybe for a month.
Kima?
Yes, that's correct.
And there was a couple other guys in there too.
Well, you have to be careful because they can say Hawaiian arts, but is it really this? The lua is the only native art to the people, the ancient people. Now, like I said before, a lot of arts traveled through and were refined and were actually created on the land. And so thus you have the Hawaiian blah, 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 and the Hawaiian blah, blah, blah. Do they have roots in Hawaii? Possibly, but they're not native.
Do you have any? Okay. So I know that the Captain Cook story is something that pretty splintery under the skin of the Hawaiian people. Was there any conflict between the Europeans and your native people that this could have been used?
Oh, for sure. But, you know, we were in the ancestors were enthralled with these metal weapons that the, you know, white devil brought. So, I mean, they, you know, it's just such a different way of, you know, we could even talk about, I'll just bring it up right now, sex, you know, and how that was an integral part of the culture and there were no diseases. And it was a way to exemplify the people's God, which was nature. You know, there's a lot of deities that people write about and scholars have written about, but really they're just representations of nature's elements. The interesting thing with the visitors is that, I think, the native people really just were so giving and they really believed that in that sense, the karma of it all, not that word, but the essence of it, sharing and relying on one another and that we truly do affect one another, which my God, what a difference in today's world. Right. And so when the visitors came, they did bestow gifts and, women and men even, and just all sorts of things that were valuable to us. But, you know, the sailors also brought a lot of diseases and didn't value the women in the same way or understood their purpose in the culture in the same way that the natives did.
You're dealing with sailors, right?
The navigators.
The STD outbreak, yeah. Right. The STD outbreak and those people from Europe at that point was really bad. The Europeans were going through some significant efforts in trying to bring the sexually transmitted disease thing under control. So I would imagine if that hit a population that had absolutely no contact with that before, that would have been devastating.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. But, you know, as far as Captain Cook, I think there's different accounts of how he really died. You know, but there was folklore before that about, you know, the whiter god coming in an all white sailed boat. And here we go. That's when Captain Cook showed up and they thought it was Lono. So all the more they wanted to please and give him anything that he wanted. So...
this is interesting because this is real similar to what happened in South America.
Yeah.
And the Spanish rolling in on that. I get questions from people. They go, hey, do you think, you know, I get that one. Do you think, and I'm like, this is all going to be speculation, but do you think a Viking could be an Aztec warrior? And people that come from the Aztec lineage won't like my answer, but I'm going to say, yeah, I think so. Pretty readily. But you're dealing with a guy that's probably twice the size. You're dealing with a person that has got armor. You're dealing with high-end steel weapons and then you're dealing with another culture that had limited information. For a long time in my life, I really believed that there was something special about white people because of our technological advantages that we had over other cultures. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I found out that information in ancient times traveled east and west, not north and south. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't take an indigenous animal, pack animal, from the bottom of South America and have it go all the way up to Canada because it can't eat the foliage all the way up. The point where you've got to stop. You're going to run into deserts and things like that where we're natural barriers. So your people and the South American people face the same limited information input as where the Spanish happened to land on top of a very rich iron ore in Toledo. Mm-hmm. And we're next to the Middle East, so they had a flow of information. from the cradle of life, which is in the Middle East. So the reason I say that the Aztec would lose this battle is because they were trying to please the gods as well. And what they had was weapons that, like, if Aztec ran in the house and hit me, you know, I would win. It's, I'm not saying that the weapons didn't work. I'm saying that they were weapons that teeth in them and doesn't penetrate armor. They were trying to capture people for sacrifices, where Vikings are trying to get rid of you so they can occupy you.
Correct.
And so what I think that your people were probably facing, if they were good natured, are really good, or were really good at just getting rid of folks. And I'm glad they left something behind, but on the other sense, it's pretty devastating probably what they did to the culture, and we probably never know the full extent of that.
That's true. It's true. Yeah.
So, but I am interested, is there any folklore out there of traditional Hawaiian warrior takes on, where in the hell is Captain Cook from? Is he English?
Yeah, he's British. Yeah, English.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, there was, I mean, it was actually quite brutal. So it was the missionaries really that were kind of grossed out and horrified by the display of how brutal the native art was. And so they used the religious aspect to first ban the hula, saying that any idle non-working time actually serves the devil. And, you know, and wanting to accept the, you know, the new God that has been introduced, and they were, you know, put in clothes, and they were not allowed to speak their language anymore. And they were thrown into schools, and of course, learning the Bible, that they were no longer allowed to hula. But it wasn't really just about hula. It was because they found it too sensual, too sexual. They didn't understand the movements of the hips and the movements of the arms. It was just too much for the missionaries. It was against the word. So shortly
this,
after
this the, sounds like when I moved back to Montana.
Yeah, it's interesting.
They're like, yeah, everything that you do is got to stop. We're gonna change all that.
Yeah, reprogram.
Right. So that your story that you're telling me is exactly, I think it became known as Manifest Destiny.
Ah, interesting.
And the I don't know that there is a native people over here that wasn't given the same essential treatment.
Yeah, ultimatum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so shortly after that, the lua was banned for really no good reason. They just, so the warriors then took it underground and they practiced at night in the dark, in the darkness. And so, you know, of course, making another, their eyesight and their ears, their hearing much more keen. And then they disguised it in the hula for a little bit before it was fully banned. So that, you know, some of the missionaries thought they were just practicing dance, and it was men, so it wasn't so sensual. Yeah.
So this is like capoeira now.
Yeah, it really is. I think there's also a Filipino art that kind of suffered the same, but I forget its name. So yeah, interesting stuff.
How is the attitude in general over Europeans now in Hawaii? I hear stories, but I don't know. I'd like to hear it from the horse's mouth what the general attitude really is. I have Hawaiian friends, and we get along famously.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
It's different. I think it's just different, you know, what island you go to and what parts of each island. You know, there's, of course, the touristy areas where everyone seems to be really welcome. But, you know, in the outskirts, sometimes, no, not really. They're not really treated very well. There's that thing. It's funny. There's that term that someone made up, reverse discrimination, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's right, just right. Discrimination.
Right.
But I find it hysterical. Anyway, it's, you know, it's obviously I was on the bus one day there was a young gentleman that was, you know, Hawaiian. And there was a very elderly woman who was white, and it's very clear, you know, that he was not going to allow her to sit down, and became quite angry because she was standing close to him and she couldn't really hold herself up. So I gave her my seat and he glared at me. Or, you know, I can stay at the Hilton Hawaiian Village. And as I'm checking in, I can be treated differently because I should really be, you know, cleaning the hotel room, not actually staying there. So there's some weird island norms out there that are really quite disturbing. And not speaking pidgin, I must be, you know, on the radio or, you know, an anchor woman. And, you know, I don't speak the pidgin. And, you know, I have to put, I'm not 300 pounds. I am not tatted all over my body. And, you know, that somehow today makes me less Hawaiian, which is ridiculous. And I spent, I mean, even being mixed, like I'm half Viking, you know, half Scandinavian. And, you know, I'm too dark to be accepted there. And then I'm too light to be accepted back in the islands. And so, you know, at some point in my existence, I just had to say, you know, fuck it. And you are who you are. And learn more about all of it. And learn what is similar, what is different, and just be who you are. Be better than your parents. There's that term hybrid vigor in agriculture. You take two species and you mate them, and it comes out obviously with offspring. That offspring is intended, if it's, you know, architected properly, to be stronger than its parents. And I'm hoping that that's the case with me. And I try to, we'll get into, you know, delaying aging or minimizing the mileage and what we can do later this podcast. But I mean, that's really where, you know, ancestry is important, and I really have reverence for it. But at the same time, this is my lifetime right now. And I really have to make the most of it and take the best and move forward from there. So
that's a good, it's unfortunate that a lot of people can't embrace that. There's, I see it inside of the wannabe Viking culture as well. So I point out to people, sometimes people go, "Hey coach, you would be back in the day, you would be an amazing warrior." And I'd say, you know what? Probably not. I'd probably be a really good boat builder. Now, my view on that is you don't come into the shipyard and pick a fight. But, I mean, I'm not – what I look at as a warrior, these people that were warriors, they were looking for this opportunity to utilize their skills. And I came into the martial arts – a little bit different. And this is going to wind back to the ideology of culture here that we're talking about. To just be left alone.
Yes.
To be able to do things and protect it. Yeah. So when I look at people that say things, I've heard that the Viking Brotherhood is a bloodline, not a decision. And I thought, no, nonsense. Huh. They did a lot of raping. Mm-hmm. So yeah. The bloodline thing is out, in my opinion. And I've got some pretty awesome Black friends here in town, and they're a member of this group as well.
Awesome.
And I don't think I'm upsetting anybody by saying, listen, the Black guy can be as Viking as me. And actually there's a clan. This is a little bit on topic. There's a Scottish clan that I see up at the Estes Park Scottish Games, who has a Black Scottish clan leader.
Love it.
He's the clan chieftain. And if he knows more and if he's willing to do more for the clan, then he deserves the position. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't stop looking at these cultural identities as racial identities, mm-hmm. we're going to lose them when people get mixed.
And absolutely.
Depart.
Yes.
And so we're talking about, so I enjoy African history, Hawaiian history. I mean, give me this stuff because it's human history now.
Yeah.
It's, if we don't preserve human history, we're just going to have this new stuff that's trending. We're just going to end up with a bunch of trends.
Which we don't control.
Right. So I wonder, I mean, how much grief did you get from the Norwegian side, and how much grief did you get from the Polynesian side for being this new and probably a new improved model?
Oh, it wasn't viewed like that initially. I mean, you think of the 70s, right? Which, you know, there's very few mixtures. It really, it was quite segregated in the States. And so you know, this, my Scandinavian side was all in the Chicago and Minnesota area, and now they're in mostly in Chicago and Indiana. They've kind of migrated down. But I don't know. My parents were so, you know, the cultural aspect within them too, it was so strong that, you know, they argued all the time. And so it wasn't about acceptance back then. I think there were just these societal roles, male, female, and gender, you know, or ethnicity. And so when two of those mix, I don't know how the world viewed it, but I can tell you it didn't go well. Both sides disowned the other. My father forbid me to learn anything about the culture, ironically, which I think is. Oh, he was the Hawaiian mix. Yeah. My mother is the Scandinavian, the 5'10 Scandinavian model actress, valedictorian. Okay. So they met in Chicago when he traveled to Chicago, and then he enrolled in school, and then somehow they met there. Mundelein and Loyola, so all girls, all boys, and they were married fairly quickly. And then they had 5 kids, and, you know, we moved to Southern California. Well, I moved to Hawaii for my first year of life, and then we were stationed in, you know, Southern California forever. My father wasn't in the military, but I say it that way because we moved around a lot. I mean, we went to 13 different schools by the time I ended third grade. So I was always the new girl. And I think that's why I'm able to adapt today in any situation. But harder for the other kids, you know, my 4 siblings that were all younger than me. But now they've all moved back, you know, to the colder weather. And now today it's, we've had cats poisoned. The police called on us, and my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, called me an it or thing and refused to see me. So, you know, it wasn't always. And I looked funny. I had this big forehead. I still have that big forehead, these huge eyes, you know, it's just different looking, you know. But when people even today talk, you know, will approach, or, you know, even growing up, oh, you're kind of pretty for being blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, I'm not, you know, what does that mean? You know, or you're pretty smart for being a girl. There's the gender one. Or what are you with that face, like they're smelling half shit and half like fragrance, like, you know, almost asking, like they're asking about your dog, like what breed are you? I mean, it's just, I think people just don't realize how they come off. But now today it's so amazing to be exotic. And I'm like, why, how right. in the world did this change? You know, it's fascinating to me, you know?
I dropped my kids off at the school. It wasn't too long ago, and they were having this all the kids had bleached their hair.
Oh, interesting.
And so everybody had blonde hair, and I dropped them off, and I froze, and the boys were like, what's going on? I'm like, this looks like 1985. Everybody was blonde. I felt like, yeah, I was in a time warp. And when I was in school, you're right, because everybody did kind of look like me.
Mm.
And now my own children, for example, look more like you.
Oh.
They're half Asian.
Okay.
And their mother goes, I'm Korean. And I'm like, I was like, I don't know, I think you're Mongolian. And the boys came out with the purple dot above their butt,
yeah,
right on their tailbone, which is a Mongol trait.
It sure is.
And so my boys are partially Mongolian, and I call one of them the Khan, and the other one is the Ronin.
I love it.
Yeah. They, amazing kids.
Yeah.
But they, I think by mixing, we're better, most certainly because we aren't related to ourselves.
Oh, that's helpful.
It sounds silly, but here's the crazy thing. I started when I was dating like white women. I would do some research on them and find out that our families have been in like physical contact for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
And then I'm like, hey, I bet somebody thought somebody was hot. And in an 800-year period, and it appears that we came over on the same ship, and then you followed us, our families followed each other down through the Virginias and into Florida, down through our Georgia into Florida, and then over across Louisiana, then made our way into Texas, where we parted ways.
Wow.
And we were with each other in more than one sense of a branch of a family. That was just one branch of the family. And then her one of her grandfathers on the other side, great-great-grandfathers on the other side, had built the Scott Monument in Glasgow.
Beautiful.
For one of my family members, Sir Walter Scott. So, like, man, we've been in contact since the beginning of when we could probably assume the beginning started.
Wow.
Because people didn't transport much back in those days.
No, they didn't.
Right. And so we were still together, and on more than just one side of my family. That, what I just explained, was the Scott family and the Blaylock family being together. And then, I don't know if you've heard of this, Maddie Blaylock. She was, notorious woman. So, one of Maddie Blaylock's relatives. And